Humble our hearts before Almighty Yahweh. Father, as we come before you on this special occasion, this one of the seven Moedim that you have called us out to observe, to keep as a memorial, to understand the meaning, to grasp the truths that are in each of these days. We're so grateful, Almighty Yahweh, that you have shown us the truth, you have shown us your ways that each of us can glean and each of us can understand deeper, that we will one day know that when Yahshua returns, these things have been fulfilled, and that these days that we're keeping now look forward to that time, and that your kingdom would come and your will be done on this earth. So we thank you, Almighty Yahweh, for this day. We thank you for your fall festivals that we'll soon be enjoying, and we thank you for guiding your people into truth. May it all be a blessing for each of us, as you have promised, and that each of us will rejoice in understanding you and more of your will. This prayer now, this petition, we ask in Yahshua's name. Hallelujah. You may be seated. Well, blessed Yom Teruah, the day of the awakening blast. This is the time when the trumpet was sounded. Israel was seeking Yahweh, and he extended an invitation, really, to come and see his face. As we were sitting there last night about midnight wondering what we should do, they had the three confirmations of this new moon sighting, and we questioned, about the integrity and the character of those who saw it, because these are the only ones that we know of that did see it, and went ahead and decided it was legitimate and the people could be trusted. I got an email this morning, as I came to services. It says, "Hello, Alan. So good to get your update. I sent one out at about 2 in the morning to all the people on the email list so that they would know that this is the time to observe. This is the one that's always so difficult, because when you see it, it begins. When you don't see it, you got to make plans either way." He says, "When I first saw the initial report, I was thinking that the network had jumped the gun. I would want to interview those fellows for confirmatory specifics, especially in these marginal conditions. I later learned that the reputation of the witnesses was sterling. Think about what happened. Sometime back, no one called by Yahweh's name saw the new moon, though some Muslims in California saw it. Thus, Yahweh did not yet want to reveal the date to his people. Last night, three of our witnesses saw it, yet not a single Muslim saw it anywhere, even in Arizona, New Mexico, or California. See the email I forwarded below. I'm fascinated that in one season, Yahweh hides the new moon from us until he desires that we see it, and then another season he reveals it to us before anyone else can see it. I guess I'm making the case that he really is in control of revealing these things. As long as we play by consistent rules, we will be guided therein. The avalanche of negative reports from devout Muslims, including New Mexico, Arizona, California, places this year's sighting in the, quote, unexpected miracle department. This really is our new moon. Hallelujah. Let's roll. Michael." I guess you know who that is. And I have to attribute this thought to my wife this morning. She said, some of us were talking, and why is it for the last 3 years we've had such a difficult time with this one? A really difficult time with the new moon sighting. Could it be? We were told, Yahshua said, that no man will know the day or the hour. Nobody's going to know it but Yahweh himself, not even the angels. Perhaps there's a lesson here. Yahweh's going to reveal it when he reveals it. We just have to go by what he reveals. And if Yahshua does indeed return at the Feast of Trumpets, which all indications in Scripture have a good possibility, then it's all going to be in Yahweh's hands. It's all in his divine plan. Well, this is the first day of the seventh month. Jewish tradition says it's the anniversary of creation, as well as a universal day of judgment. I don't know about the first and how you'd ever figure that, who was keeping records back in the Garden of Eden, but the second we do know, we do have good evidence for. This biblical month is significant for a number of important reasons. It contains the most feasts of any month of the year. There are four feasts in the seventh month. Clearly an important time. And they reveal much about Yahshua's return and his kingdom. And if these feasts encapsulate his salvation plan, which the scriptures indeed show, then the last feasts tell us a lot about the culmination of his plan. The fall feasts are the finale, so to speak, in Yahweh's plan for man and his creation. Yahweh's plan of salvation is depicted by the harvest cycles, which the feasts are closely tied to. And that is a theme that's so embedded in the scriptures. You know, there's scientists that want to go out and calculate everything. But Yahweh's word shows this is a harvest plan all the way through. Even the motifs and the metaphors talk about harvest, about gathering in, about the saints, about, you know, the sickle and the reapers and the angels coming, and on and on and on. And if we look at how Yahweh established his creation at the beginning, what did he do? He put man in a garden. Again, it's a harvest, all about growing and working the soil and understanding that this is the way Yahweh meant it to be from the beginning. That we're to be tied to the earth so that we depend on him and not on some bank or something. It's all depicted by a harvest. And this month is the time of year when the general harvest occurs, which has important, of course, symbolic implications in the gathering of the saints and the spiritual harvest. If you have never investigated, and these are for those who are new to this, and never investigated the feasts, you really suffer in your grasp of prophecy and the whole understanding of what Yahweh's doing here. What do you know about farming? You know, the farmers used to plant by the moon, especially those of the new moon. The full moon. Maybe the new moon, too. I don't know. But they say certain things grow better at a certain time of the month or the month. And the feast days are built on an agro foundation, from planting and growing to first fruits to the harvest. It's all part of a harvest cycle, symbolically speaking, that Yahweh's established. And he teaches us his plan of salvation in that way. And unless we as Yahweh's people understand and keep his feast, we're looking through a thick haze, kind of like trying to see that moon. And I was looking last night, and the clouds were right there, right where I wanted to look. Up north, clear as a bell. There again, Yahweh had his plan. He was going to reveal it the way he wanted to, not the way I wanted to. So we have the three set cycles, the three harvest times, the early, the middle, and the latter, depicted by the barley, the wheat, and the general harvest of tabernacles. And all these parallels identify different salvation plans of Yahweh and different times of that plan. Besides the Feast of Trumpets, the Jews have several other names they call this time, these Hebrew names. Rosh Hashanah, the head of the year, or beginning of the year, and that would be the civil year, because we know that the year doesn't begin at the fall time, it begins in Abib. But that's what they call it, Rosh Hashanah, that's their civil year. And that's a message in itself, of course, understanding that. Then you have Yom Teruah, otherwise known as the day of the blowing the horn, the day of the awakening blast. Yom Hadin, judgment day. So they understand, too, that this day is significant in terms of Yahshua's return and judgment. And Yom HaZikaron, the day of remembrance. Well, if you look at the blowing of the trumpet, this day is to awake us from our slumber. You know, it's been 4+ months since we've had a feast. And man is typically, he kind of modifies his life to his situation, if you know what I mean. He's habit-centered. And whatever he's accustomed to do, he becomes. And if he gets used to a period of no worship or a period of no feasts, that's kind of the way his thinking goes. And he gets lackadaisical. And he gets kind of slovenly about it and loses a little zeal. So Yahweh periodically wakes everybody up. And it comes with a bang in this one, a blowing of a trumpet, awakening blast. Everybody gets on fire. And he uses the world in part to show the contrast between him and what man has done. And if man is close to the scriptures, those scriptures will be in his heart. That'll be a part of him. When brethren spend a week together at tabernacles, they're inspired, they're energized, they're on fire, and they come back and want to do things and get going. And then just like the glow from Moses coming down from Sinai, it fades after a while. So Yahweh says, well, time for another feast. So we start all over at Passover unleavened bread. Yahweh knows the nature of man, and nothing shakes one loose from his complacency like the blast of a trumpet. There's a certain type of thunder you sometimes hear that you don't hear it often, and it's a certain, I guess the atmospheric conditions have to be just right, but you hear this thunder and it cracks, and you can hear it start from one end of the sky and go all the way to the other. Maybe you know what I'm talking about. You've heard it. It's not a dull rumble like normal thunder. This stuff, I mean, pow! And it probably starts because it's right there at your house, you know. That's probably how it really sounds when you're near to it. And Israel was that close to Yahweh, and that was the sound they heard. And they said, don't let us get near him and let him talk to us because we're going to die. We can't handle that. Yahweh doesn't mumble. When Yahweh speaks, you know it. The mountain shook. The sky was filled with fire and smoke. Israel thought their world was unraveling. So we fast forward many years now. Kind of leave, fade out that scene and come into another. Many, many years now. And Jerusalem has been destroyed, been sitting there, you know, uninhabited for a long time. But the people following Nehemiah want to bring it back to life. They've come back from captivity. The Persians have let them go from their captivity. And they want to go back to their homes. So Nehemiah is going back to Jerusalem to rebuild the city. There was a revival as he scattered, or as the scattered people were brought back from exile. But it wasn't an easy task, obviously, to rebuild a city. I mean, how much time does it take to rebuild the, or even just clear the Twin Tower debris? How long did that take? Years, and we got machinery. So you know, this was a hard, difficult time. And it took a lot of work. And it wasn't just repositioning those massive stones around the wall. There was much, much more to do. And then they had opposition from the surrounding people, the Gentiles, to rebuilding it. So they had to work with a trowel in one hand and a sword in the other. Let's read Nehemiah chapter 8 here. The Jews had worked hard to rebuild to this point the walls of the city, and now they're complete. It was the first day, by the way, of the seventh month. The very first day. What is that? That's today. First day of the seventh month. And all the people gathered themselves together as one man into the street that was before the water gate. And they spake unto Ezra the scribe to bring the book of the law of Moses, which Yahweh had commanded to Israel. And Ezra the priest brought the law before the congregation, both of men and women, and all that could hear with understanding upon the first day of the seventh month. Significant that they would bring the law out on this day. And he read therein before the street that was before the water gate from the morning until midday, before the men and women and those that could understand, and the ears of all the people were attentive unto the book of the law. The exact opposite of what we see today. They'll tell you that old law, and don't you even try to follow it because that's dead works. Now, these people wanted to hear it because they knew this was Yahweh's will. This was Yahweh speaking. And Ezra the scribe stood upon a pulpit of wood, which they had made for the purpose. And beside him stood Mattathiah and Shema and Ananiah and Uriah and Hilkiah and Masariah on his right hand, on his left. He had Padiah and Mishael and Malchi and Hashum and Hashbadana, Zechariah and Meshulam. And Ezra opened the book in the sight of all the people, for he was above all the people. And when he opened it, all the people stood up. And Ezra blessed Yahweh, the great Elohim. And all the people answered, Amen, Amen, with lifting up their hands. And they bowed their heads and worshipped Yahweh with their faces to the ground. Also, Jeshua and Benai, and I'm going to skip all those names because you won't remember them anyway. And the Levites caused the people to understand the law, and the people stood in their place. So he was actually sermonizing. He was reading it and saying, you understand that? No, I don't understand it. Well, you see, and then he would explain what was in the law. And they read in the book of the law of Elohim distinctly. That means it gave the sense and caused them to understand the reading. Because they had been without it for so long, this was all new to them. This is like you going out, going downtown, middle of town here, opening up your Bible, and try to explain it to these people walking by. They wouldn't understand it. Well, there might be a few that have an inkling, but they wouldn't understand it the way Yahweh meant it to be understood. So you'd have to sit and explain it to them. Explain to the feast days. Explain the Sabbath isn't the first day of the week. You know, explain that he has a name. You know, do you know him? Well, he's got a name. Oh, I didn't know that. Nobody ever taught me he had a name. Yeah, he does. 7,000 times he says, this is my name, essentially. And so you'd have to sit and explain it all because people are ignorant today. And Nehemiah, which is, and there's a few more names here, Shathan, Ezra the priest and the scribe and the Levites and that taught the people, said unto all the people, this day is holy unto Yahweh your Elohim. Mourn not nor weep, for all the people wept. When they heard the words of the law, they wept. Why? Because they realized how much at fault they were. Then he said unto them, go your way, eat the fat, drink the sweet, and sent portions unto them for whom nothing is prepared. So he gave them a gift of food. For this day is holy unto Yahweh, neither be ye sorry. For the joy of Yahweh is your strength. Now, that one meaning that the Jews call this day, they call it a solemn feast because of judgment, Yom Hadin. But here we see that it's a joyous time because Yahweh is strengthening these people in his word. So the Levites stilled all the people, saying, hold your peace, for the day is holy, neither be ye grieved. And all the people went their way to eat and to drink and to send portions and to make great mirth. Because they had understood the words that were declared unto them. Certainly the time, if this is the time of Yahshua's return, Feast of Trumpets, it's going to be an austere time. But it's also, of course, a good time. Because we're going to have the salvation come to us. It's going to be a time of rejoicing as well. When all this junk that we see in this world will be done away. I'm going to talk about that after a bit. All the people went their way. They ate, they drank, gave portions, shared, had a good time. They were happy. And then, on the second day, were gathered together the chief of the fathers of all the peoples, the priests, the Levites, unto Ezra the scribe, even to understand the words of the law. And they found written in the law, which Yahweh had commanded by Moses, that the children of Israel should dwell in booths in the feast of the seventh month. You people need to travel to a certain place and dwell in temporary dwellings, it said. Oh, well, that sounds like fun. And they explained why they did that. Because that's, you know, the children of Israel came out of Egypt. That's why they dwelled in booths. So they had to have something, and it was temporary. And that they should publish and proclaim in all their cities and in Jerusalem, saying, go forth unto the mount and fetch olive branches and pine branches and myrtle branches and palm branches and branches of thick trees to make booths as it is written. So they went forth and brought them and so forth. I could read the rest of it, speaking basically of the tabernacles of time ahead here. Anyway, in Leviticus chapter 23:23 is an important verse for us. 23:23-25. And Yahweh said unto Moses, saying, speak unto the children of Israel, saying, in the seventh month, in the first day of the month, shall you have a Sabbath, a memorial, a blowing of trumpets, a holy convocation. You can blow trumpets all day long if you want to. That's what it's all about. Brother Paul came up this morning. I was still in the shower. He wanted the shofar, and he was blowing it all over the place. Blew it all over out here, blew it over there. I got here, and he says, can I go out and blow it some more? I said, yeah. So he went out and blew it some more. He blew it everywhere. Said, could you hear it? I said, you're good. And he came in here and blew it. And that's what this feast is all about. It's about blowing that trumpet. Certainly, it woke up a few people around here if they're, you know, not at work. But that's what it's all about. And then, you shall do no servile work, verse 25. You shall offer an offering made by fire unto Yahweh. And Yahweh spake unto Moses, saying, and I want to stop there. Numbers 29:1. This is a commanded assembly, and that's why we're here. We're here to do as Yahweh said, to tell our boss, I'll be gone today. A special time I have to keep. 29 and verse 1. And they say, why? Because they don't know. They have to be taught. Well, this is one of the seven annual feast days. Look on your calendar, and you'll see it. And on your calendar, it'll be called Rosh Hashanah. And that's what the Jews do. They keep it. Anyway, 29 verse 1, in the seventh month, on the first day of the month, you shall have an holy convocation. You shall do no servile work. It is a day of blowing the trumpets unto you. Blowing and blowing and blowing and blowing and blowing and blowing. A number of reasons have been given as to why the trumpet should be blown this day, besides the ones we've mentioned. You know, anytime you have the approach of Yahweh in his magnificence, his presence, however it's felt, you have a blowing of trumpets, a sounding of a trumpet. You found it on Sinai. You find it when Yahshua returns. You know, the angel is going to blow those seven trumpets, and then they're going to be broken down into different things, and each one is going to bring on something else. But the trumpet sounded a king's coronation, as it did, you know, in King Solomon's time, his inauguration, 120 trumpets blew, 2 Chronicles 5:12. Of course, when the law was given in Sinai, we had more trumpets because we have the presence of what? A presence of Yahweh himself in his law. So blow a trumpet. Blow a trumpet. This is an announcement of something holy. The prophets typically compared their messages with the sound of trumpets. The shofar, Isaiah 58:1, typical. Amos 3:6-7, the trumpet. Zephaniah 1:14 speaks of the return of Yahshua, prophetic, with the blast of the trumpet as King of Kings. And it'll be a coronation. And he takes control of this world, wrest it from the arms of man who's done nothing but destroy and, you know, tried to contain the world and rule it for himself. Yahshua's going to say, it's not yours, it's mine, and these people are mine, and they're going to be ruling now, not you. So often, well, and then we have there's more, that you have the resurrection of the saints, and the trumpet's going to sound, remember? 1 Thessalonians 4:16, and the dead Messiah rise first, sound of a trumpet, because again, Yahweh's presence is near. Often when something significant occurred in the scriptures, it was accompanied by that trumpet. The battle alarms that Israel was to blow come to mind. Yahweh's leading his people. Yahshua's return in the trumpet sound. Fight the rebellious kingdoms. Numbers 10 are examples of what we go through this every year, but it can't hurt to look at it again. Numbers 10 is the sound of the trumpet, what it means. And he says, make, verse 2, make two trumpets of silver of a whole piece, not welded together, but a whole piece. Shall you make them, that they may use them for the calling of the assembly, for the journeying of the camps. And that there's a special sound they give. When you blow With them, all the assembly shall assemble themselves together, the door of the tabernacle. If you blow with one trumpet, a lesser sound, then the princes and the heads of the thousands of Israel shall gather. And when you blow an alarm, the camps that are in the east shall go forth. Everybody knew their alarm. Everybody knew the one that was significant to them. When you blow an alarm the second time, then the camps that lie on the south shall take their journey, and they shall blow an alarm for their journeys. Everything is organized. And you know, you can do so much more when things are organized than when things are disorganized. Everybody running into each other and losing stuff. And, you know, when Yahweh, when the people went out, Moses said they went out harnessed like a soldier battalion. They went out very organized. And you always see these pictures, ragtag, you know, crowds of people over here, animals, you know, in amongst them, and kids dragging behind. That's not how it was. They went out very organized. But when the congregation is to be gathered together, you shall blow, but you shall not sound an alarm. There's another special sound. And the sons of Aaron, the priests, shall blow with the trumpets. They shall be to you for an ordinance forever throughout your generations. And then if you go to war in your land, if you have to go to war, you shall blow an alarm with the trumpets. You shall be remembered before Yahweh, your Elohim, and you shall be saved from your enemies. So there's the significance. Blowing the trumpet has a promise to it. He said, you do it this way, and Yahweh is going to bless you. Now, it's not just the sound of the trumpet. Of course, it's obedience and everything, but that's part of it, and that's why we do it. It meant action. No time to waste. Israel would know immediately what each of those sounds meant. Okay, that means that group over there, those, you know, three tribes over there, go, and we'll wait for our sound. They had to be ready at a moment's notice because they're out there and they had enemies all over the place. I mean, they're right amongst them. You know, they're out in that land that the enemies want to drive them out of. Israel would know immediately, and they had to be ready. Today we've got the rantings of a Iranian leader and his intent to disintegrate the country of Israel. Brother was telling me that they actually have some jets over in Israel running 24/7. Engines running all the time. So if any time their satellite spots a missile heading their direction from Iran, they're up in the air and they're ready to go. Just like it was in this time. They had to be ready. They had to go. When the time comes, time to move. And that special trumpet sound was it. Well, in verse 10 of Numbers 10, we see it says, and in the days of your gladness and in your solemn days and in the beginnings of your months, you shall blow with the trumpets over your burnt offerings and over the sacrifices, your peace offerings, that they may be to you for a memorial before your Elohim. I am Yahweh, your Elohim. So in the gladness feast, the happy feast, the solemn days, the Moedim, beginning of months, the new moons, blow the trumpet. Why do you think they were always blowing trumpets? Why are they prominent in Yahweh's feast days? Well, there's basically three Hebrew words that translators have derived the words feast and feasts. First, there's Mishtah, that's 4960 in Strong's, and it simply means to eat a meal, have a banquet. Abraham did a Mishtah back in Genesis 21:8 when Isaac was weaned. He was so happy, he said, let's have a meal. Let's go to Ryan's. Queen Vashti made a meal for women of the house in Esther 1:9. Samson made a Mishtah as well. It's just a dinner. It's no spiritual significance other than a celebration. Then there's Chag, which is its verbal root. Chagag means a observe a festival, like a feast, like we do today, in honor of Yahweh, to observe a festival. Numbers 22:82 and 22:87. Chag is the normal Hebrew word in the Old Testament translated feast, and basically means a traveling observance, a pilgrimage to go somewhere. And it was almost always exclusively in that sense. And that comes from Chagag, which is its underlying verb. So, yeah, Israel kept the Passover in their homes, but when they traveled out to the wilderness, they kept what? Unleavened bread, a feast. All of the 28 references to feast in Exodus Leviticus, Numbers, and Deuteronomy are taken from Chag or Chagag. Feast, pilgrimage, to observe a festival. And Numbers 10, 3 to 10 defines each of those trumpets, as we mentioned, how you assemble, get ready to go to each of these things. All four elements, I believe, likely will occur when Yahshua returns. The trumpet's going to call his people together. It says, the scripture tells us, they'll be gathered from one end of the heavens to the other, one end of earth to the other. And during a feast, because we read it, will be a time appointed that Yahshua will return. And you can find that in Daniel 8:19 and 11:27 and verse 35. They all say the end shall be at the time appointed. I think it means more than just appointed in Yahweh's mind. I believe it means appointed for man to keep. A moed. Hebrews dictionary word 4150 is the moed, and it is translated from the same word of solemn feast. Appointed time. At the time appointed at the solemn feast, you can insert, Yahshua is going to return. They'll be journeying to keep these feasts. You can't keep a pilgrim feast at home. Simply isn't right, according to Yahweh. You must go to the place that Yahweh places his name. But more than that, there'll be the wilderness place of safety to journey to. And we know Revelation 19, I'd like you to turn there, verse 14, there's going to be the subduing of the nations when he returns. And just as Israel blew the trumpet, you know, the walls of Jericho came tumbling down. Yahshua is going to blow that trumpet, or his angels will, and Yahweh is going to perform a mighty act when he returns. Actually, many mighty acts. Revelation, again, 19, verse 14. Let's read there. Many people don't believe this. You're going to read something here that many people today would say isn't in the Bible, because they don't believe it. And the armies which were in heaven followed him upon white horses, clothed in fine linen, white and clean. And out of his mouth goes a sharp sword, that with it he should smite the nations, and he shall rule them with a rod of iron, and he treads the winepress of the fierceness and wrath of Almighty Elohim. Wrath of Yahweh. That's something people can't get their minds around. Joshua's going to come back in wrath? No. You see, he's a baby in somebody's arms, you know, weak and defenseless. Or he's nailed up there with his arms all tied up, nailed down, again, defenseless. And he's just meek. And he would never hurt anybody. He loves everybody. He will forgive everybody. And it says that he should smite the nations, and he should rule them with a rod of iron, and he treadeth the winepress of the fierceness and wrath of Almighty Elohim. And it says he has on his vesture and on his thigh, and that should really be, I think, on his banner, a name written, King of Kings and Master of Masters. King of Kings. So he's going to come back, and it's going to be a terrible time on this earth. It's going to be wake-up time for this earth. There's going to be war. They're not going to like it, and they're going to fight. A war such as we've never seen ever in history, and ever again we'll see. And he says he'll take his people into the wilderness for protection on the wings of eagles. People believe that Yahshua's coming back with a smile, a pat on the back. Oh, that's all right. You did a pretty good job. You completely ignored me, but you did a pretty good job. They can't possibly believe he's coming back in fury. And they have been duped to believe that a follower of Yahshua has to be totally forgiving of everyone for all sin, all time. And they believe Yahshua taught this. The true Savior of the Bible has been stolen away and been replaced by an imposter in their minds. Identity theft. Thank you, Brother Paul. I like that. I might use that. Good title for a booklet, maybe. Identity theft. He's not the one of the scriptures. He's been stolen. Here's a scripture. Let's turn to Luke chapter 12. It's the exact opposite of what you're told today. Luke chapter 12 and verse 49. It's the exact opposite of what most people have been taught and what most people believe. And it says, I am come to send fire on the earth, and what will I if it be already kindled? I have come to send fire on the earth. That's what he said. He's going to burn. No more is the earth going to be destroyed by flood, although Satan's going to try, but it's going to be swallowed up when he tries to destroy the elect. But he says he will destroy this earth by fire. He's going to burn up all the dross and all the what offends. Tolerance. We need to be tolerant. Forgive the sinner, but love. Or what is it? Love the sinner, but don't love his sin. Tolerance. You know, somebody sent me an email. It was excellent, and it's talking about what's happening over in Europe right now. Tolerance of foreigners among Europeans today, they do it as to be seen as, you know, diverse, friendly, and it's getting them into very deep trouble. Right now, they're about to be overrun by the hordes over in Europe. Not even like in the time of, you know, when they attacked over in Spain. Now it's going to be a subtle thing where they can actually take over just by sheer numbers. Tolerance. Putting revolving doors on prisons and sending criminals right back out to do it again because nobody has the guts to stand up for the law and put people where they belong for what they did. Make them pay. Matthew 10, verse 34. Tolerance is destroying this world. I'm not talking about being unloving. I'm talking about when Yahweh says you pay the consequences of your sin, you pay it. So you learn the lesson. That's the whole idea. Learn the lesson of what you need to pay for so that you won't do it again. Think not that I am come to send peace on earth. I come not to send peace, but a sword. Very clear. How can anybody argue with that? Yet you tell somebody that and they'll argue. No. That can't be true. What Bible are you reading anyway? You know, we hear that. I not send peace but a sword. All you have to do is read it and don't ignore it. And then you'll find the truth as well. Yahshua's going to subdue the nations. And he's not going to do it by pats on the back. You often hear that the religion that Yahshua started in the New Testament was one of tolerance. And that's the total difference between that and the Old Testament. The Old Testament is nothing but a austere, mighty one who, you know, vaporized people at the drop of a hat. And the New Testament, it's all grace and love. Well, there is a greater tolerance for sin in the New Testament. We have to admit that, but ultimately, you know, the ways of sin is death, Yahshua said. So we need to get with it. Matthew 10:34, he said he came not to send peace but a sword. He'll put down by force all the evil that we find in this world. What a wonderful time to get rid of the evil. In 1 Corinthians 15:24, again, he has a mission. He's coming back for a purpose. And this Feast of Trumpets is probably the initial announcement of that when Yahshua returns. Verse 24. Where, he says, then comes the end when he shall have delivered up the kingdom to Elohim, even the Father, and when he shall have put down all rule and all authority and power, for he must reign till he puts all enemies under his feet. And the last enemy that shall be destroyed is death. So he's going to fight his enemies, even the enemy of death. Revelation 6:14, it's called the great day of his wrath. He's angry. He's had enough. It's gone on and on, got worse and worse, and he says, enough. And only he knows when he reaches the end of his limit. But he has a limit, and more than likely, we're going to see it in our day. In Revelation 6:14, it's called, and 17, called the great day of his wrath. Revelation 19:14 said he's going to smite the nations. Why? Why would he smite the nations if they're ignorant? And the armies which were in heaven followed him, and upon white horses clothed in fine linen, white and clean. And we read this already. Out of his mouth goes forth a sharp, two-edged sword. It cuts both ways. Yahshua does the judging. Yahshua will be the judge, because Yahshua was here. He lived this life. What better person, what better to know and understand what we went through than actually someone who experienced it as well? Because, you know, man doesn't change. Sin is sin. It's been that way forever. And so, interesting. Let's turn to verse 9 of Revelation 19. He said unto me, blessed are they which are called unto the marriage supper of the Lamb. And he said unto me, these are the true sayings of Elohim. And I fell at his feet to worship him. And he said unto me, see that you not do it. I am your fellow servant, this is the angel, and your brethren that have the testimony of Yahshua. Worship Elohim, worship Yahweh, for the testimony of Yahshua is the spirit of prophecy. The spirit of prophecy. Verse 7, back up. Let us be glad and rejoice and give honor to him, for the marriage of the Lamb is come, and his wife has made herself ready. Well, I thought it was all his work. Now it says that his bride makes herself ready. How? Next verse. And to her was granted that she should be arrayed in fine linen, clean and white, for the fine linen is what? The righteousness of the saints. The righteousness of the saints. Following Yahweh's will, obeying his word. Yahshua spoke about this parable over in Matthew 22. I think that it's an interesting parallel here. And we can learn a lot between the two, because it parallels the Revelation 19, but it's also parables can also be prophetic. Matthew 22, verse 1. Yahshua answered and spake unto them again by parables and said, the kingdom of heaven is like unto a certain king which made a marriage for his son and sent forth his servants to call them that were bidden to the wedding. And they would not come. They wouldn't come to the wedding. Again, he sent forth another servant. Okay, so let's stop right there. Marriage. In the Greek, that word is also wedding feast. Wedding feast. And verse 3 indicates that the first ones sent out weren't listened to. John the Baptist, perhaps. Perhaps this is what Yahshua was referring to. John the Baptist was essentially ignored. I mean, he baptized some, but for the most part, the world would not accept him. They thought he was a weirdo, walking around in tattered clothes and biting off heads of grasshoppers and whatever else he did. So they thought he was strange, and they didn't accept in mass what he was saying. So then he did what? He sent forth other servants in verse 4, saying, tell them which are bidden, behold, I have prepared my dinner, my oxen, my fatlings are killed, and all things are ready, come unto the marriage. So here we have another set of people to go out and proclaim the news, proclaim the truth. Who could that be? Could it be Peter and the 12? I think so. And Paul, perhaps, proclaiming that all things were ready. And what did they do? On this set of disciples, this set of evangelists, let's call them. Well, verse 5, it says, they made light of it and went their ways, one to his farm, another to his merchandise, You can have that. That's a bunch of baloney. I'm going back to work. And the remnant, what did they do? They took his servants and treated them spitefully and slew them. We know that all the disciples met some kind of, virtually all of them, an untimely death. Slew them. So they're gone. Except a few that, you know, resulted from their work and carried on the work. But when the king heard thereof that he was wroth, he sent forth his armies and destroyed those murderers and burned up their city. Now this also happened, some say Titus, you know, when Jerusalem was destroyed. But I believe it's also dual, and I think this is, and maybe even triple. What's the word, tertiary? I don't know. It's a triple meaning, you know, layered. I think Yahshua's not only telling a parable, he's also talking about what's happening there. He's also talking about what's in the future. They made light of it, and they killed him. And verse 6 says, the remnant took his servants and entreated them spitefully and slew them. When the king heard it, he comes down in wrath, in his anger for what they had done. And then he says to his servants, the wedding is ready, but they which were bidden were not worthy. They were not worthy. Go ye therefore into the highways, as many as you shall find, bid to the marriage. So those servants went out into the highways and gathered together all as many as they found. They found both bad and good, and the wedding was furnished with guests. Many are called, but only the good are chosen. The rest are bad. They're not chosen. And the bride makes herself ready. Interesting, over in this parable, verse 12, they got the wedding set up, all the chairs are in, everybody's sitting down, and they're walking around, and, oh, this guy isn't dressed up. There's something wrong here. What did we say? Well, let's read it. He said unto him, friend, how did you come in here not having a wedding garment? He was speechless. He was speechless. And said the king to the servants, bind him hand and foot and take him away and cast him into outer darkness. There shall be weeping and gnashing of teeth. Could on one of our levels this be Judas? He had no excuse for himself. Remember, he went out and hanged himself. And as Yahshua said, better had that man not been born. To the effect that this man is done for. He's going to be thrown into the lake of fire. He was called. He was there, baptized. And yet what happened? He turned. He turned from the truth. So he didn't have a wedding garment on. He didn't have the robe of righteousness. He committed a heinous sin. And he was speechless of his act of betrayal. He represents those invited, called, but not chosen because they had a serious problem. In Revelation 19:8, righteousness is dikatoma in the Greek, meaning a righteous ordinance. Revelation 19:8. Keep that in mind. And I'm back in Matthew. Hang on, I'll get there. 19:8. And what we're talking about is a righteous ordinance. It's tied to Yahweh's law. And to her was granted that she should be arrayed in fine linen, clean and white, for the fine linen is the righteousness of the saints. Righteousness of the saints. And it's implied in the Greek that it's a law righteousness, ordinance righteousness. And that's the woman right here who keeps his laws. Revelation 12, 14, 14, 12, 22, 14. All of them talk about they have the testimony of Yahshua and the law. These are the ones that will be granted a place in Yahweh's kingdom, a position of rulership as a kingdom of priests. Over in 1 Corinthians 15:52, prophecy of the return of Yahshua, says, in a moment, in the twinkling of an eye, at the last trump, the final trump is going to sound. Trumpet, for the trumpet shall sound, and the dead shall be raised incorruptible, and we shall be changed. When that trumpet sounds, there's going to be a change come, physical, in those that who are called and those that are found faithful because they had a wedding garment on, righteous and clean. In 1 Thessalonians 4:16, another famous passage we're all familiar with, again, speaking of Yahshua's return. And we know that Yahshua's going to come with the sound of the trumpet. The dead Messiah will rise first. Then the alive people shall also join them. For Messiah shall descend from heaven with the shout, voice of the archangel, and the trump. Three things, a shout. It'd be interesting to delve into that sometime. Exactly what does that mean? A shout, a voice of the archangel. What does he say? I don't know. Maybe he's calling the people forward, and the trumpet sound. And then the dead rise first. Many people don't understand the importance of the feast days. They just don't get it. They just don't understand why we would keep these Old Testament days when, if they would look at it, they would see these Old Testament days scattered throughout the New Testament. You see even their beloved disciples keeping them. They're commanded and sanctioned in Yahweh's word. They're just as important as the Ten Commandments, and yet universally ignored by most. But these days have so much to offer. Think about it. What they have to give us. They're tied to the plan of very salvation plan. And the wedding feast describes the feast by which Yahshua is going to be joined to the bride. I mean, it's just, there's so much here in Yahweh's days. Leviticus 27:3. I guess we better read the law and discover the... This is the summation of the book of Leviticus, verse 27:34. These are the commandments. Now, what do we find in Leviticus 23? The feast days, right? A very explicit, very detailed examination of every one of the feasts, you know, brought out to us in detailed form so that we can know what to do on these days and how they're to be kept. When he gets all done, the final chapter of this book of Leviticus, he says, these are the commandments which Yahweh commanded Moses for the children of Israel in Mount Sinai. It includes everything in this book. Everything in the book of Leviticus, and we know that that includes the Sabbath, his feasts, and the commandments, of course. Every one of them. No other book contains so many direct words of Yahweh than does the book of Leviticus. Here we find his active presence, his involvement in man, his involvement in his people. And we find, for instance, Yahweh spake, quote, Yahweh spake 36 times. I am Yahweh, 21 times. I am Yahweh your Elohim, 21 times. I am, 3 times. And I, Yahweh, do, twice, total of 83 times. He reveals himself by quoting himself. This is the book of worship. Trumpets is part of that, and it's only for those who truly seek Yahweh. The rest are blinded. They don't understand. Israel had a problem that would last for many centuries. They were taken into captivity, and they couldn't keep the feasts because they're in captivity. And they virtually, there's no record. They knew where the sabbatical was. Even worse, the Jubilee. So we have to try to extrapolate the best we can because we don't have a lot of information on those two things, figure out when they are. I think the sabbatical, the best we can determine, will be 2008, 2009. If you find, you can divide it for some reason, if we are indeed correct, and we have a lot of, you know, evidence that we are, that it can be divisible by 7, which makes a lot of sense, too, even in the Gregorian system. So if someone says it's 2002, just go ahead and divide it by 7. If it doesn't, it probably not that date. Anyway, Nehemiah had gone back to Jerusalem to help rebuild the city. and there was a revival as the scattered people returned from exile, and it was a difficult task. Not just the work of, you know, rebuilding, but to get people reoriented. It is so hard. We've talked about this recently so many times. How to get people to understand the importance of the feasts? They've grown up all their lives keeping what one brother calls the beast days, you know, the pagan holidays. All their lives, they're not oriented toward the biblical days. And it's so hard to get them to understand that, to rethink, hey, what's important? What does Yahweh really command? That's hard because they fall back into their own ways and think, oh, well, there's so many, you know, oppositional problems with it, with family, friends, you know, just my own inertia going a different direction. I've got to counter all of that and turn around and come to a feast. They don't realize the blessings when they do that. Just have the faith to do it. You know, this is the time when people are going to be tried. They plan to come, they got the money, and then the car breaks down, or then the wife gives them trouble, or the, you know, unconverted family member, or the friend, and maybe the job problem kicks in. This is when Satan tries hard. He doesn't want them to come. And you're going to see a few drop out because of it. We do it every year. And you got to overcome that. You got to be strong enough to say, I don't care. If I got to walk there, I'll be there. Might take me a while. See, from Missouri. I'll probably get there at the end of the feast, but I'm going to get there at least one day. Doggone it. I'm not going to let him take me. I'm not going to let him do it. Oh, HaSatan is not going to discourage me. That's the kind of dedication, Yahweh. You don't think he's going to bless that? You bet he will. You bet he'll bless that. But people are too easy to give up. Just too much effort. I just don't have the money. I'm not feeling too well. I mean, some people really are sick, and that's a problem. But I'm talking about people that just looking for an excuse. Looking for an excuse, and that's not what Yahweh wants. He wants someone who shows the dedication, who shows the love of him. Let's turn to, we've already been through Nehemiah. Let's not go there. 2 Samuel 6. You know, we have a tradition that at the Feast of Tabernacles, unlike Xmas, that we give gifts to one another. Is that wrong? No. Is it following the ways of the world? No. It's following the ways of Scripture, actually. Turn to 2 Samuel 6 and verse 19. This is when the ark was brought back to Jerusalem. Remember, David danced around. His wife says, oh, you're obscene, dancing in your skivvies. And David didn't care. He just kept dancing and rejoiced and gave everyone a meal of wine and bread and meat. He was so thrilled. And this guy, when he was happy because his heart was right in Yahweh. And he didn't care. Verse 14, he danced before Yahweh with all his might. And David was girded with the linen ephod. And David and all the house of Israel brought up the ark of Yahweh with shouting and with the sound of the trumpet. I'm in verse 16. And as the ark of Yahweh came into the city of David, Michal, Saul's daughter, that's his wife, looked through a window and saw King David leaping and dancing before Yahweh, and she despised him in his heart. And he brought in the ark of Yahweh and set it in the place in the midst of the tabernacle, this time rightly, you know, on staves like you're supposed to, and nobody got hurt. And so he did it right, set it up in the tabernacle, and David offered burnt offerings to Yahweh and peace offerings before Yahweh. And as soon as David had made an end of offerings, first he offered to Yahweh, gave him his gift, the peace offerings. He blessed the people in the name of Yahweh, and he dealt among all the people, the whole multitude, as well as the women, as men, to everyone a cake of bread, a good piece of flesh, and a flagon of wine. So all the people departed, every one to his house. That was a lot. There were a lot of people around at that time. Thousands. Thousands and thousands. He gave them a gift at a very special time. Another example, Esther 9:22. Another time of giving. It says, as the days wherein the Jews rested from their enemies, and the month which was turned unto them from sorrow to joy, and from mourning into a good day, that they should take them days of feasting and joy, and of sending portions one to another, and gifts to the poor. So each one received a blessing that way. Helping the needy is implicit in Yahweh's guidance. We'll probably hear at this feast, and I hope that those doing it are successful in coming. They want to go help the needy in a great way. And Leviticus 23:22, it talks about that. And Yahweh is not negligent to those people too, for no fault of their own. Now there's a difference if someone wants to sit there and, you know, sit on the couch the rest of their life and have to take in charity. That's different. But if someone who, you know, just in their situation can't help it, Yahweh has mercy. 23:22, and when you reap the harvest of your land, you shall not make clean riddance of the corners of your field. And when you reap, neither shall you gather any gleaning of your harvest. You shall leave unto them, unto the poor, unto the stranger. I am Yahweh your Elohim. People can go out to the field. They know that there's going to be, you know, some corn over here in the corner. I can go pick it. I can bring it home and use it. Yahweh said, do that. Forced charity. Enforced charity, I guess you could say, too. Speak unto the children of Israel. Now, we just read verse 22 to do that. I am Yahweh. Speak unto the children of Israel in the seventh month, and the first day of the month, you shall have a Sabbath, a memorial, a blowing of trumpets, a holy convocation. You don't do any servile work, but you shall offer an offering made by fire unto Yahweh. So again, in the law, Yahweh commands that we come together at this time. Numbers 29:1. I don't know if we might have read this one. But hey, let's read it again. You know, repetition is always good. Good on memory. 29:1. Ever come back from vacation and can't remember your password? You know, this world is so full of passwords. It just drives me crazy. You want to do this, you want to, you have a password. You want to get on this website, you want to do that, you have to have a password. I don't remember. I don't want to use the same one over and over and over, you know. So you got to come up with something else. Well, I don't remember. You want to order something, you need a password. It's crazy. So you got to memorize passwords. It's nuts. They say Einstein could hardly even, I don't know if that's true or not, but they always say he couldn't do simple math because it cluttered up his brain. You know, anybody can do that. So he led that up to others. But anyway, in 29:1, in the seventh month, on the first day of the month, that's now, you shall have a holy convocation, a coming together, and you shall do no servile work. It is a day of blowing the trumpets unto you. And he says, offer a burnt offering, which we, in our way of doing that, have done that, offer an offering for a sweet savor unto Yahweh. One young bullock, one ram, seven lambs of the first year without blemish, their meat offerings, and he goes through all of this, very specific how he wants to be honored. So that's what we do. We find the approach and appearance of Yahweh and Yahshua, as we mentioned, are so significant that this day actually reflects that coming of Yahshua in the blowing of the trumpets. So those that don't understand these days, well, you have to learn the hard way or maybe not learn at all and have to receive the wrath of Yahweh, the judgment. Well, brethren, the rituals that we see, and people say, well, you know, that's all tied up with sacrifices and you can't keep the feast. That's all been done away. In Jeremiah 7, verse 22, we find a significant point. And you can always use this one when they tell you that. You know, they throw the baby out of the bathwater and no, it's all been done away. That's all part of that Old Testament ritual. 7:22, for I spake not unto your fathers, nor commanded them, who's that? Fathers, Israel, nor commanded them in the day that I brought them out of the land of Egypt concerning what? Burnt offerings or sacrifices. That wasn't his teaching for them. But this thing I commanded unto them, saying, obey my voice, and I'll be your Elohim. Now he doesn't, notice this, he doesn't say, I didn't command them concerning burnt offering sacrifices and the feast days and the Sabbath. No. He separates that part of his law, the burnt offering sacrifices, which you find out was added, from the rest of it, which is to obey his word, to obey his voice. Obey my voice and I'll be your mighty one. You shall be my people and walk in all the ways that I've commanded you that it may be well unto you. You want to do it? You want to be blessed? There's the key. Do you want to be blessed? Then do it. And he says, oh, if Israel had just done it. Man, oh man, if Israel had just been faithful to me, they could have conquered their enemies just like that, just holding up somebody's arms, and the enemy falls down flat, basically. He'd done all the work, the hard work for them, but they wouldn't do it. So he says, okay, you're going to have to lose some people in battle, and it's going to be a tough go till one day you'll learn to honor me. We have the same things today. Yeah, we're going to be tested once in a while. But in the long run, you know, when the balance sheet is made out, there's going to be a lot more pluses on the side of those that are obedient. In fact, the ones that really matter. That's where it's going to matter. That's where it's going to make, you know, where the iron or the rubber meets the road in the blessings that Yahweh gives for an eternity. Anything else people don't want to obey is idolatry. Putting something else. When you don't obey Yahweh, you're putting something else automatically in place of that, right? When you don't obey him, I'm not going to obey him. Well, I'm not going to go to the feast. Well, what are you going to do? Well, I'm going to be doing this and that and that. That's idolatry. That's putting something else in front of Yahweh, either family, friends, your job, something else is coming in place of Yahweh. He says, don't do that. I am Yahweh, commandment number one. I am Yahweh, obey that one. Everything else will be fine because everything else will be obeyed. People don't want to do that. People don't have a willing heart too often, and they don't want to obey. It's a natural thing. They have to overcome that. They have to humble themselves. Paul's objective was not to dispense with the old and create a new. He said, Acts 24:14, he believed all things written in the law and of the prophets. All things. Law and the prophets, Old Testament, euphemism. Romans 15:18, he said his goal was to make the Gentiles obedient by what? Word and what? Deed. Word and deed. Oh, you don't have to have works. That's works faith, works righteousness. No. He says to obey me. By that he finds that you're worthy. He knows you're not earning anything, but he's watching, and he says he will judge you by your works. He will judge you by, basically, that's speaking your heart. Your works reflect your heart. Nothing else. You know, what you do really matters. It's not what you say, it's what you do. Children learn by what you do. They watch their parents. When the parents do that, that's what they're going to do. Not necessarily what their parents say, but they're watching their actions. So he says in Deuteronomy 4:29, I want to wrap this up. I think I might have gone a little bit long, but it's feast day. And Deuteronomy 4:29, one nice thing about DVDs and CDs that you can cram a whole lot more in of a message onto them without losing it like the tapes did. And we just keep on learning and growing. 4:29 of Deuteronomy. Oh my goodness, I'm skipping pages here. All right, we have so we're really in this passage looking forward. From the Old Testament forward to today, we find the message. But if from hence you shall seek Yahweh your Elohim, you shall find him. If you seek him with what? All your heart and with all your soul. If you really desire, you will find him. And when you are in tribulation and all these things are come upon you, remember that. Remember the words. Even in the latter days, I find that such a contrast. We're in Deuteronomy. We're in, you know, the old book. He's talking about the latter days in Deuteronomy. Isn't that interesting? If you turn to Yahweh, even in those days, see, nothing changes. When you're under the gun in those days, you turn to Yahweh, he says, then You shall be obedient unto his voice, for Yahweh your Elohim is a merciful Elohim. He will not forsake you, neither destroy you, nor forget the covenant of your fathers, which you swear unto them. All tied together in one neat little package, and people want to split it all up and say that's two-thirds of that Bible is unnecessary. You know, just amazing. The more you look at it, the more you can see it. It's just beautiful. Yahweh's plan, the same from beginning to end, and we see all these important days in there that are markers, not only in our lives, but in Yahweh's word, to show us the truth of his word. Comforting words. If you seek him with all your heart and soul, you'll find him. If you really want to go, there's a fellow, you'll meet him at the feast from up north here, one of the states up north, and they were just questioning, you know, they brand new, they want to come to the feast, but man, they had a little problem with money, and I said, just go somehow. Set your mind to it. Yahweh will make a way. Guess what? They're coming. He said, some money came. We're coming. You'll meet him at the feast. Wonderful. It's the heart. It's the wanting to come that makes the difference. If you go negative on him, Yahweh's just going to, you know, okay, go. Go your way. But if you really want to serve him, he'll make it happen. He will make it happen. The feasts are all about seeking him, about seeking his face. And may our whole hearts and souls be involved as we begin the final observance of this year and of the holy year of Yahweh, as we keep the remaining three after today, of Yahweh's feast days. In rejoice and learn and become closer to the one we serve. May Yahweh bless you.